Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Well, back in the day, people were furious when Winston used the word like instead of as in its famous jingle. We're going to talk about what makes people mad about words these days later in the show. And speaking of correct usage, the Oxford English Dictionary added about 500 new words and phrases last month. One of them was sexting. For the handful of you that somehow don't know what that means, the OED defines it as the sending of sexually explicit photographs or messages via mobile phone. For teenagers in the new era of smartphones, sexting is a common occurrence. It seems as if just about every teen has sent or received or forwarded some kind of sext message. Many school districts, trying to get a handle on the issue, have treated it as a criminal offense. But the LAUSD is now planning to roll out a new education program about sexting in the fall. Here to tell us more is LA Times education reporter Teresa Watanabe. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Nice to have you on the show. So tell us, what will the new program entail?
Well, LAUSD is rolling out what I believe may be the most ambitious campaign in the state of California to warn teens about the risks of sexting. They are planning to make a video which will be posted both on their website and shown in every school in the district. They are also planning to prepare a curriculum and handouts to give to both families and students about the dangers of sexting.
And what are the core messages that the school district wants to communicate with the campaign?
The core message, according to LA Police Chief Steven Zipperman, is what happens now matters later. And so they really want to urge teens to think twice about pushing that send button before they send off a nude picture of themselves or sexually explicit messages to other people, because it can obviously be distributed and forwarded and sent all over. And the police chief notes that it could have, you know, negative consequences on your chances for a job or getting into college admissions, not to mention the personal humiliation and embarrassment the sender would suffer.
And where is this going to be rolled out? High schools, middle schools?
They said that they're going to try to hit every single school in LAUSD, which is, you know, more than 900 schools from elementary through high school. Obviously, the curriculum would be age appropriate. And I'm sure that what they tell high schoolers is going to be very different than what they tell elementary school children.
Wow, really wide range of ages there. Well, you talked to LA Schools Police Chief Zipperman. What did he say about sexting as a criminal versus an education issue?
He did say that sexting can bleed over into criminal violations. And he mentioned that there are laws against child pornography. There are also laws against distribution of, quote, obscene material in California. But what's interesting is that since this issue kind of exploded in prominence in the last few years, more than 20 states in the country have passed laws addressing sexting. Some of them have actually downgraded the penalties from felonies to misdemeanors, and others have beefed up the penalties. But what's interesting, in California, there have been at least 4 attempts to address sexting, and all of them have failed.
Well, how will the program handle the non-criminal sexting, that voluntary sexting that happens between two students?
I think that's where people pretty much universally agree that in that case, the best thing is just education. There could be some suspensions or expulsions if it rises to the level of bullying or harassment. But if it's voluntary texting between two teens, which, you know, happens, according to the research, 1 of every 4 teens in the nation do this, they will probably just focus on the educational benefits of not texting and the consequences if this thing gets out beyond just you and your boyfriend or you and your girlfriend.
Well, all of this can get into a gray area, and a lot of this was highlighted by a situation in Venice High. Remind us what that case involved, and is that what really got the school district's attention focused on this issue?
Well, in March, there was a group of boys at Venice High School who apparently had been having, allegedly been having sex with a couple girls there for more than a year. And somehow a photo of two of the teenagers having sex ended up being posted somewhere on social media. And that, of course, got distributed to a larger number of people. And a student or a group of students brought that photo to the attention of school authorities, who then reported it to school police. The police, I think, worked with LAPD to look into it. And according to the law enforcement, a couple of the girls, or one of the girls, said that at least some of the sexual acts were coerced. So then that brought in the possible criminal violation of sexual assault laws. And so the police went in there and actually arrested 15 of the boys. But the district attorney in May announced that it was not filing any charges due to insufficient evidence. However, the whole issue of sexting and nude pictures and sexual acts being depicted in photos that were sent around, actually it drew national headlines. LAUSD told me that this sexting campaign is not related to Venice High School. They said it's just a natural extension of their policies against bullying, but certainly it did draw attention to the potential dangers of sexting.
Well, I'm thinking that school messaging campaigns like this can often strike the wrong tone with students, or mm-hmm. they can out and out backfire, right? Mm-hmm. So what sense do you have from students about their thoughts on how schools are reacting to this trend of sexting?
Well, it's interesting because I did talk to a couple of students, one at Venice High School, one who just graduated from Manual Arts High School. They both told me that this is so common. It's almost the new normal among adolescents. I think that that may be something that's based on, you know, particular schools or particular demographics. I mean, I think research shows there's more sexting among, for instance, lower income than higher income. And there are variances by race as well. But they told me that around their circles, this is so common. And that if you went in there, you know, heavy-handed, and the school police came in there and they kicked kids out, that would be completely the wrong way to address the issue. They both urged that LAUSD offer more comprehensive, in-depth sex education classes. They said that those classes are almost non-existent. They do have health classes, but they say sex education is barely touched upon. And they said adolescents are just hungry for accurate information about sex, because this is the age where teens become naturally curious about sex, and many of them actually start experimenting with it. So they're saying sex education, they're saying more counselors, more psychologists, and even more teachers, where they can have a safe space to discuss the issues of sex and relationships and sexting, rather than some heavy-handed effort to, you know, pound it into your head that you shouldn't do this or your future will be ruined forever.
Teresa Watanabe is an education reporter for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
For a look at sexting nationwide, we turn now to Elizabeth Englander. She's the director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center and a professor of psychology at Bridgewater State University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you've heard some details of this LAUSD plan to educate teens and kids about the dangers of sexting. What's your impression of their approach?
Well, I think you're right in thinking that the devil is really in the details, and it's the approach that you take that is most important. But I will say that their whole idea that education is the way to handle this is a wonderful thing to see. And I think it's great that they're approaching it through education. The difficulty is what messages the educational content is going to be, because we know that there are some problems with sexting that are usually not addressed in education. And we know others that people do tend to emphasize aren't really going to be very effective with teenagers.
Well, and that was my question, because the LAUSD plan, at least according to some reports, seems to focus on the ramifications of sexting and potential criminal violations or personal consequences. And is that a good way to go? Because when I think about my own experience in school with driver's ed, say movies like Red Asphalt and other social engineering films and programs that I grew up with, inevitably it all seems so hysterical and overblown. And that can prompt kids to dismiss the whole campaign, right?
Right. We don't want kids to think that they can't talk to adults and that we don't know, we don't have any information that's helpful with this. The problem is that if all we emphasize is that this is a crime, that you can be prosecuted, that this can ruin your life, we're talking to groups of kids where they're sitting there and they're thinking, well, you know, I've sexted and most of the kids in my class have sexted and nothing terrible has happened to us. So this person really must not know what they're talking about, and you immediately lose your audience. On the other hand, we do have to let kids know when they're doing something illegal. That's important. So I think that it's tricky to do really effective education on this, and my own sense is that the education is probably better left to counselors and health educators, people who are professionals at knowing how to talk to kids about these kinds of issues.
Well, I am curious about your research and what it shows about how many teenagers are sexting and who is doing it.
Well, there are two issues. One is that overall we found about what everybody else finds, which is that about a quarter, one out of four kids tell us that they've sexted during high school. But the numbers get much higher as the kids get older. And so it's important to understand that this isn't a rare behavior. Kids don't look at it as deviant. It's not kids who have poor self-esteem necessarily, or kids who are troubled in other ways who are doing it. But the biggest problem that we ran across was really the issue of kids being pressured or pushed or nagged or pestered or even coerced or bullied into sexting. And that seemed to me a much more common and much more serious problem that usually isn't addressed in any educational programs. And that's a big issue that we really need to focus with kids.
So perhaps this LA Unified program is part of an anti-bullying campaign that it's positioned well. But what does the research show about the consequences of sexting then, if maybe 25% of kids or around that number are doing it? Mm-hmm. If a teenager sends a nude photo to a friend, how big a risk is he or she taking?
Well, it's hard. The first thing to understand is nobody has any long-term data. So we really don't know what the risk is over 10 years or 15 years. Could the photo pop up again in many years? It could. Nobody really knows. The only data we have is short-term data. And there have really been two big studies on this, the study we did in Massachusetts and the study that was done in Texas by Jeff Temple. And in both of those studies, we found the same thing, which is that in the short term, most kids who sexted report to us that really nothing much happened one way or another. They didn't become more popular, they didn't get a new boyfriend, but they didn't get in trouble either, and they didn't get teased by their friends or have their parents find out. Most kids reported that. Probably the kids who reported the worst outcomes were the kids who told us that they were pressured or coerced into sexting. Those kids reported a lot of negative emotions, feeling really bad about having sexted.
Well, again, in your research, what do teenagers say about the consequences of sexting and how they should be addressed by their public institutions like schools and law enforcement?
Well, what we have found is that the way to address them is not to lecture kids on the dangers, but instead to talk to them about what they've heard and what they think, and to get them to a place where they understand that not all kids are sexting. They don't have to choose this. They don't have to let other people push or pressure them into doing it. Instead, they can really begin to think about themselves and what's right and what's wrong and what they are comfortable with. And that kind of approach tends to be much, much more effective than just lecturing kids on dangers. And that's been validated in research on many different risk behaviors that kids get involved in, not just sexting, on things like programs to prevent drunk driving or not buckling your seatbelt. We know that not all kids engage in risk, and teenagers often think that everyone's doing it. And if they understand that not everybody's doing it, then they may feel freer to make other choices.
So values-based approach. Elizabeth Englander, director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center, mouthful, and a professor of psychology at Bridgewater State University. Nice of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of LAUSD's attempt to educate students about sexting? Is it needed, or much ado about nothing? Let us know on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at KCRW. Press play. Just ahead, Aaron Robinson of Car and Driver has a fascinating backstory to the news about Toyota's highest-ranking female executive stepping down in the wake of a puzzling arrest on suspected drug charges. That and other car news, that's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Julie Hamp, the highest-ranking woman ever at Toyota, was arrested in Japan in June. She was suspected of importing the painkiller oxycodone. Now a news service there is reporting that she's being released and the charges dropped. We're talking today about that story and other car news with Aaron Robinson. He's our Press Play car guy and the executive editor of Car and Driver. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Now, I really didn't know what to make of this Toyota executive's arrest. Why don't we back up and tell us Julie Hamp's backstory at Toyota?
Well, Julie Hamp is an industry veteran. She's in the public relations side. She was hired at Toyota to be the global communications director. She was 20 years with General Motors. She actually started her career giving tours of the old Buick City plant in Flint, Michigan, which is no longer there. Partly because of the company she currently works for, Toyota, or worked for, Toyota. She just resigned. She and her father worked in the auto industry, so she's a longtime auto industry veteran. She went for 5 years to PepsiCo, and then Toyota came calling with this offer, which was kind of part of a big diversity movement at Toyota. Because coming out of the big sudden acceleration scandal and the quality issues that Toyota experienced about 6-7 years ago, the company president, Akio Toyoda, who is related to the founder, decided that Toyota was too close, too insular, and they needed to bring in people from other walks of life, women, into the kind of the inner sanctum of the company to kind of break up this sort of insular culture. So they also hired an African-American named Christopher Reynolds to be their sort of global chief legal counsel. A Frenchman named Didier Leroy, who will come up in a minute, to be one of their vice presidents. And so they brought in a lot of foreigners and also Julie Hamp, a woman, into what had traditionally been a Japanese male corporate culture. And that has stirred things up.
And then she was arrested.
Correct. Apparently her father sent her a package that was marked necklaces, and inside the package was a bunch of plastic, cheap plastic dime store necklaces, and down at the bottom were 57 pills of oxycodone, which is not illegal in the United States, and it's not actually illegal in Japan. It's just very heavily controlled, and you're not allowed to import it. So she got arrested for that.
So it seems like just a mistake, which was my impression from this of the story, perhaps, in the first place. But what's the upshot of it?
Right. Well, there's more going on here that meets the eye. And there was a story in the Japan Times last week suggesting that there's a little bit of xenophobia happening in Japan. Apparently, a man named Eriko Yamatani, who is the head of the Public Safety Commission, which runs the police forces, he's, I guess, somewhat affiliated with right-wing ultra-nationalists in Japan. And they have viewed the coming in of foreigners into Toyota, which is a pillar of Japanese industry, and they viewed that somewhat negatively. And the rumor is, and the discussion is that the nationalists want to send a signal to Toyota saying, foreigners are trouble, do not bring them into your company. And here, look what we did to the head of your communications
department. So she's becoming the poster child of this campaign.
Right, so they're making an example of her. Yeah, she's a drug runner. And she has now resigned her job. She's been in jail for the last 15, 20 days, whatever it is. And supposedly now that she's resigned, they're going to drop all the charges and let her go. So if you believe this theory that was put forth by Japan Times, that this is kind of discrimination at work, then they got what they wanted and sent a signal to Toyota saying, don't bring in foreigners, not into the inner sanctum.
Really interesting. But moving on, Kirk Kerkorian, the billionaire investor, died last month. And he was known for his investments in casinos and film studios. So why are we talking about him in our car segment?
Well, you know, Kirk Kerkorian, eighth grade dropout, eventually went to become ranked 41st on the Forbes list of world's richest people. He had an active interest in the U.S. auto industry, and he at one time or another was the single largest shareholder in Ford, GM, and Chrysler. He actually tried to buy Chrysler twice. In 1995, he tried to do a leveraged buyout of the company, which the management at Chrysler deemed a hostile takeover. And as a response to get away from Kerkorian, they threw themselves into the hands of Daimler and formed a merger, which became Daimler Chrysler. That didn't work out so great. So as that was falling apart just a few years later, Kerkorian came back and tried to buy the company again, offered a lot of money to buy the company, but they sold the company instead to Cerberus Management, a private equity firm. So
He had his hands in a lot of pies.
History would have been very different had Kerkorian actually purchased the company. Probably Chrysler would be in better shape today had Kerkorian gotten it the first time, because the idea was they were going to buy it, privatize the company, and let the current management at Chrysler, who was very competent at the time, run the company. But instead, Daimler came in, and it was a disaster. He's also tried to get GM to merge with Renault-Nissan. He took a big stake in Ford, which cost him a lot of money. It was kind of his last industry play. He ended up losing about $600 million when the Lehman Brothers bank collapsed and the financial crisis hit. So he admitted in 2011, his last interview, that it was a mistake to buy the Ford stock.
Wow. Well, speaking of Chrysler, the head of Fiat Chrysler has been wooing GM for years and doesn't seem to be giving up, right? Is a merger possible?
Right. Yeah. There was just an article in the industry trade pubs last week saying that this is the rumor that will not die, that FCA or Fiat Chrysler, now that they're joined, are trying to merge with GM, and there's some active talks going. And a lot of this has to do with FCA chairman Sergio Marchionne. It's kind of his force of personality that's keeping this thing going. There would be definitely some synergy by having the two companies join, but the odds stacked against it are quite high. One of the reasons to join is to get Opel and Fiat to join in Europe. Both are quite weak in Europe. But you'd have a German company, Opel, merging with an Italian company, Fiat, and
that would make some interesting.
There's a long pattern of Germans and Italians not getting along so good, right? And so, big culture clashes. There's another belief that the GM's Chinese partner, and GM's doing quite good business in China right now, that they will move to stop the merger. So there's a lot weighed against it, but the rumor just won't die. And no doubt they're talking and looking at it and studying, because that's what companies do. They study stuff before they decide that it's a bad idea.
Well, before I let you go, I know you're a motorcycle rider, and it seems that there's new helmet technology that may make riding your bike safer.
That's right. A local company called 60 in Brea has developed a new type of helmet which puts these kind of little shock absorbers inside the helmet. For decades, helmets have been made basically the same way, with a very hard outer shell and then a styrofoam liner. And they have been made to meet a test that was created by a foundation called the Snell Memorial Foundation, which is named for a driver who was killed in the 1950s. And they have these very rigorous tests where they bang helmets against stuff to test them for a durability. But there's a lot of criticism that that actually hasn't produced the safest helmets. That's produced very tough helmets, but tough helmets transmit shock to the head because they're tough rather than being absorbent. So this company in Brea has developed this helmet with an inner liner that moves actually relative to the outer skin of the helmet. And this is supposedly better. Now, Bell Helmets, which is a big maker, has adopted the technology and has come out with their own helmet. These are quite expensive. They're about $650 to $750. But what price is your safety?
Well, exactly. And I ride a bike, and Bell makes bike helmets. Could we see this technology having an effect on other helmets for other sports?
A lot of companies are talking to 60 about taking this technology to other sports, snowboarding, bicycling, skiing. So this technology could be used far and wide in the sports world.
Well, this is great. Thanks, Aaron.
Always a pleasure.
Aaron Robinson, he's executive editor of Car and Driver. Well, coming up, ballerina Misty Copeland is breaking race barriers at the American Ballet Theater, but she owes at least some of her success to pioneering dance icons like LA's own Carmen de Lavallade. De Lavallade performed in films and on Broadway and with the ABT. She also persuaded her school friend to switch from gymnastics to dance. His name? Alvin Ailey. Carmen de Lavallade. That's after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press play. I'm Barbara Bocave. Icons make up an exclusive club. You have Audrey Hepburn, Madonna, Marlon Brando. Well, in the dance world, Carmen de Lavallade is a bona fide icon. She's been on Broadway, in movies, and on television. She broke boundaries as an African-American in a white-dominated industry and danced with the Metropolitan Opera, as well as pioneering companies like Lester Horton Dance Theater and Alvin Ailey. Now at 84, she's still performing. Her recent one-woman show was called As I Remember It. But before all that, Carmen de Lavallade was just a girl from Los Angeles. This weekend, she returns for a visit. She's speaking on Sunday at the Second Baptist Church about the history of Central Avenue and her family. The event is part of the 20th Annual Central Avenue Festival. And Carmen de Lavallade, it is such a treat to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, your parents came from New Orleans to Los Angeles in the 1920s. What are your earliest memories of the city?
Oh, my goodness. When you're little, I just remember that it was a lot of empty lots with poppies and citrus trees. We start out in Watts, believe it or not, and then Vernon City.
Which back then wasn't it farmland?
Pretty much. And it was a mixed neighborhood. It was Mexican and Black and Asian. Oh, it was always a mixed neighborhood. I loved it.
Well, I know your aunt looked after you and your sisters at one point because your mother suffered from illness, right, and went into a sanitarium.
Yes, she did. We were quite young, yes. Mainly Auntie Adele, who had a bookshop on Central Avenue.
Right, Hugh Gordon
Bookshop. We didn't know how important it was, that it was one of the only, I suppose, bookshops that carried, in those days, Negro history. And people came from all over the world to Auntie's shop.
Well, your cousin Janet Collins
was the first
African-American prima donna for New York's Metropolitan Opera in the 1950s, and just a tremendous achievement. So was she how you got into dance?
I wanted to be like Janet. In those days, you couldn't go to a dance class. If you went to a dance class and they were white students, they would walk out. You could not be in a dance studio. So she had to work on her own or be taught by somebody outside of a class. And that's very difficult.
And what did she tell you about what she went through as a black ballerina coming up in the dance world?
Well, I did not find out about this until years later. Janet didn't say very much about it. You know, she was a big star at that time. And then, but at the same time, she couldn't be a part of a ballet company. And I think she was on her own most of the time. And there was a loneliness there, yes. I, on the other hand, came to New York City and joined House of Flowers, where I met my husband, Jeffrey Holder. And I was more inclined to work with every company I could possibly work with.
I am curious what you think of Misty Copeland, now made the first black principal dancer for the American Ballet Theatre. And
well,
it seems
to
me
it's fantastic.
Well, yeah, it seems though as if it shows us both how much the ballet world has evolved and also how little has changed when she speaks about what she has gone through in her career.
Well, it goes back to Janet again, because when she was about 16, she auditioned for Leon Massine for the Ballets Russes de Monte Carlo, and she did a knockout audition, but he said he would like to hire her, but she would have to lighten her skin. She'd have to put on white makeup. Yes, it's still a problem. I think Misty explained it. I saw her on The View this morning, and she said that it is a European dance form, you see, and I think in the minds it's white.
What kind of casual or overt racism did you deal with coming up yourself as a dancer?
You know, I have to admit that I worked with people. I was fortunate to work with people who didn't care.
Well, I do remember a story that you told about an appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah. I was supposed to dance with Glenn Tetley, actually, and I was not allowed to. We had to bring in Claude Thompson. Prime time at that time. You couldn't have mixed cast. You couldn't dance together, so to speak.
Well, you've had such a tremendous influence on African-American dance. And for instance, you got Alvin Ailey to study ballet. How did that happen?
We were in high school and junior high school together, and he was on the gymnastics team, and he moved beautifully. You know, I said, you ought to come to dance class. And that's how he got interested in choreography. And, you know the rest from there. We had no idea. He's as famous as Coca-Cola, you know.
And you ended up going to New York together, where you met your future husband, Jeffrey Holder, who turned out to be together for 59 years. And he was a choreographer and an actor and a painter.
Oh, he was everything.
Right?
Yes. There wasn't anything Jeffrey wouldn't attempt, you know. He just loved life.
Well, both of you worked in so many different artistic fields, and there's so much interest right now in creativity and how to nurture it and the science of it. It made me wonder what your practice is and also what your husband's approach was to maintain inspiration and foster it.
Didn't think about it, just kept going. You get an idea and you go with it. You know, if you think about it too much, you can't think of obstacles.
Well, I'm interested in creative breakthroughs in your work, and one of the dances that you're most known for is Portrait of Billie, a modern dance tribute to Billie Holiday. And actors, you know, often tell me when I ask them about this that they find one key to unlock an interpretation of a role, and it might be a line of text or it's a hand gesture or something along those lines. Was that your experience with Billie Holiday, some small insight that opened up how you would craft your performance?
Well, this was choreographed by John Butler, and I met her once at dinner, and I was very impressed. I mean, she was very quiet, very sweet, didn't say very much. I felt she was a very lonely person, but when I was working on Billie, I don't know, I changed every time I performed it.
And that's the living part of it. That's what imbues life, right, into your performance, that every time it's different.
But all my experiences go right back to Los Angeles, California. I'm just amazed that I, you know, came out of L.A. and I've had all these experiences in so many wonderful, wonderful places. Because as far as Central Avenue, I have to tell you what I remember about Central Avenue is that there was the Dunbar Hotel and the Club Alabama and the Lincoln Theater, where I saw Peg Leg Bates, the most extraordinary dancer. Yes, he had a peg leg, and he can get on and balance on it and,
do that must have been something to see.
I've never forgotten it. Of course, Auntie's Bookshop and the Rosebud Theater and and Thomas Jefferson High School. As you grow older, you look back and you think, that's all a part of who you are now.
I'm sure people are always asking you about aging, and I've read that you've often said about it that you lose something and you gain something. So what does a dancer gain in their 80s?
I just use with what I have. I'm not going to try and be who I was 20 years ago. You can't. But I'm finding, especially in my piece that I do, The Creation, as I got older, there were certain things that were leaving, or I hurt myself or whatever. And I remember at one point finding that my legs were very tired after some big job that I had, and I had a date do Creation, and my legs were not moving. And I thought, I'm in trouble. And then all of a sudden I thought, well, it's a solo, who's going to know? And number two, it's really text. It's a poem. It's words, And then I did less of body and more of the story. And all of a sudden, that's the first time I heard the words. And I thought, this is interesting. There is where creativity comes in. You just take it in a little different direction. You just change the color a little bit. You just adapt. And you find that you really can come up with some really wonderful, wonderful ways finding ways of saying what you have to say, movement-wise or theater-wise. And besides, I really don't think age. I just think of having to deal with who I am now and find out what do I have now and how I can use. Because there are things that I do now I could not do. I could not have done it when I was younger because I would not have understood it, because I had not lived it.
Carmen de Lavallade is a dancer, a choreographer, and actress. She'll be at the Second Baptist Church here in L.A. on Sunday, talking about the history of Central Avenue and her family. So you can see her there. The event is part of the 20th annual Central Avenue Festival. And just in case you were wondering, she looks like she's about 60, really. It's just amazing.
She sounds like she's about 60.
Oh, Warren Olney.
Great interview.
Yeah.
Well, from Central Avenue to the presidential campaign, we're going to have a very interesting conversation, I think, with some Ron Brownstein and others who have been covering the presidential campaigns. We're going to hear a little bit about Donald Trump and what about Bernie Sanders and how long shots, people who nobody really expects to get into the White House, are still having a big impact on this campaign already this early on. And, of course, the Republicans have this massive group of candidates. It would appear that Donald Trump probably will get into the first debate.
That's it. Donald Trump's numbers, I just can't wrap my head around.
Yeah, well, he gets in, and everybody's going to have to respond to him. He's going to help to determine how this campaign goes for that party.
Great.
The Republicans are worried.
As well they should be. And you can look ahead to that show at 1. And just ahead on our show, Between You and I, Irregardless, Impactful, Your Language Pet Peeves, and that might include the phrase pet peeves. That's next. Press play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. There are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who correct other people's grammar, and then there are people who think that those people are jerks. My next guest somehow manages to bridge these two groups. Ammon Shea is a consulting editor of American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press, and he's also the author of Reading the OED. His new book is Bad English. It looks at what are commonly considered mistakes in our language, like these.
It's New Winston. The easy-drawing filter cigarette that tastes good, like a cigarette should.
Well, I'll also say that it took a little bit of conversation between you and I before I even understood.
Like, I realized that his musical sensibility was vast and very unique.
Unbelievable.
Has your life been different than what you imagined?
Yeah, a little bit.
Let me close by saying I do not underestimate the enormity of the task that lies ahead.
Those examples might sound normal to you and me, but they drive some people to violence. Shay explores how people first started speaking this way in bad English. Often the historical context puts these vilified turns of phrase in a completely new light. And Ammon Shay, it's really lovely to have you on the program.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate this book so much because I usually get uptight talking to people who write and study language, but your book is just completely liberating.
That's right, delightful to hear.
Well, right from the start, it addresses questions of grammar and of word usage that I've struggled with throughout my life, and many people do, and that's beginning with this idea of you should never begin a sentence with but or and, right?
Sure. Right. Putting aside the fact that every Bible pretty much ever translated into English has hundreds and hundreds of uses of and but beginning sentences. We've been doing this for over 1,000 years. The dirty secret is that everybody struggles with language, just some of us feel a little more comfortable about admitting it. And there has never at any point in the history of the English language been a golden error-free period during which, you know, everybody, you know, used perfect syntax and used all the right words in just the right way. We've always been full of mistakes.
Although what I just mentioned, but and, that's really a style issue. And people put that in a different category from than words. So I hardly know where to start. But let's start with hopefully.
Sure. Well, the big battle was conceded in the war against hopefully a few years ago by some when the Associated Press in 2012, they issued a tweet of all things, which I think was just kind of pouring salt in the wounds of the aggrieved grammar watchers, when they said, we now support the modern use of hopefully, instead of saying it is to be hoped. They used it in the sense of, I hope this will happen, right? And by modern sense, I'm taking that to mean the middle of the 17th century, because we've been using the word hopefully in this manner since at least 1648 and probably well before then. But ever since, you know, people have been using it this way, other people have presumably been kind of arguing against it and in a really kind of unnecessarily passionate way. Now, I applaud passion for language. I think it's a lovely thing. I am all in favor of, you know, leaping to the defense of language and having a great verve and vigor and vim and everything else passionate about it. What I deplore, however, is the one-sidedness of the conversation in which many of us are much more inclined to deprecate language use passionately than we are to celebrate it. And hopefully is a wonderful example of this in that nobody ever says, oh, isn't that interesting how the word has changed? Or isn't that interesting how this one word can fulfill these several different functions? And yet we all manage to understand what it is that the person is saying. So we do this constantly. Just every once in a while, a word will stick in our collective craws. And hopefully is one such word.
Well, so is regardless and irregardless, which people get very upset
sure.
about. There's no such word
right.
as irregardless. But you point out that they've been constantly interchangeable throughout history, including disinterested and uninterested.
The great thing about disinterested and uninterested is that they actually did mean what they are now not supposed to mean. Disinterested is popularly thought to mean impartial now. You have a disinterested judge and you have an uninterested teenager. Yet when each one was first used, they meant exactly the opposite. And they both came into the language about the same exact time, right about 1630. And nobody knows why, but they did then swap meanings, and they've kind of stuck with those meanings, but people do, you know, kind of use them interchangeably quite often. Somehow, Western civilization soldiers on, and again, we presumably know what the person is saying, even if they use the wrong one. The only point, I think, in many of these cases of correcting somebody is to say, I know something that you seem to not know, and I find that a bit offensive.
More offensive
than using the wrong word.
So you attribute it to ego.
Absolutely.
Annoyance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are so many things which one can say that is incorrect. For instance, one of the most absurd, once you kind of go down this rabbit hole, is that in the 19th century, when people started talking about grammatical errors, there was actually blowback on the phrase grammatical error, because some grammarians said, you cannot have a grammatical error because grammatical itself means correct in grammar. So it's like saying you have a correct error. And then other people said, well, no, actually, that's kind of ridiculous because we say grammatical error and you know what I'm talking about, don't you? But there were a number of, you know, guardians of the English language who, when grammatical error first started being used, insisted that that is an impossibility to speak of a grammatical error. So you can get a sense of how far you can go in defending the English language and how sometimes it can be a bit too far. One of the clips you played before was the eternally popular Between You and I, which again is certainly viewed as a mistake. It's the wrong form of the objective case. However, I mean, Shakespeare used it and, you know, all debts are cleared between you and I in the Merchant of Venice. It's something that, you know, I'm not suggesting we do away with paying attention to. I would suggest that our language is fluid. It has always been fluid and it will continue to be so. And if at any point our language stops being fluid, we have much more serious things to worry about because it will probably mean that it is dying. You know, we all have our own peeves, and far be it from me to take away that blanket of warm anger that puts you to sleep at night and keeps you comfortable. However, what I would like to point out is that we all have different peeves from each other. And it's the tricky thing about language is that once you've accepted that it will change, you no longer get to decide which ways it will change.
I did ask friends on Facebook to tell me what language really sends them into a tailspin. And what a mistake. You can imagine the response. Right. But one of them did make an interesting point about why people do get so incensed about certain perceived language issues. And he said that it's not so much incorrect usage that bothers him. It's the gratuitous repurposing of words. He's British, by business wankers, to sound fresher and more important. MBA-wielding right. consultants no longer contact customers or people in their networks. They reach out. They aren't regular humans. You see, they're messiahs extending the hand of salvation to the needy and bestowing great moral beneficence upon them. So that's fun, but it also gets to what's being conveyed by the usage, the condescension, pretentiousness, or trying to sound smarter than you are, that I think is what goads people so much.
Sure. And that is an entirely legitimate complaint. You know, I kind of think of the way that English changes, it really is the sausage factory. And unfortunately, a lot of English is made by people trying to sound smarter than they actually are, by people making simple mistakes, by people being lazy and using gratuitous kind of verbiage. That's not a new trend. It's just another part of the messy way in which language works. And there are many words that today are thought of as relatively common that were coined, you know, several hundred years ago by somebody who just wanted to sound like a smarty pants. And some of them stuck. And some of them stuck and have just come into the language. And other ones, we, for some reason that is unknown to me, we resist. I don't think there is really anything wrong with using contact as a verb. It's wrong because we think that it's wrong. One of the correlates to that is people love to hate impact as a verb. And that is widely thought of as a business thing. You know, we will impact you with our, you know, message of incentivization or whatever they say. The problem with this is that impact was a verb for 200 years before ever was a noun. It exists as a verb since 1601. It didn't start becoming used as an actual noun, like the impact that has on my brain is terrible. That doesn't come up until the end of the 18th century. So it's messy the way that the language works, but it does not make us any less able to do lovely things with it, and sometimes to do terrible things with it. I'm not arguing in defense of bad language, per se, just in the defense of language should do what it would normally do.
Well, despite yourself and all of the studying of English that you have done, are there any rules that you are a stickler for? Things that just make your brain or your ears burn when you hear them?
No.
Nothing brings out the language nudge in you. OMG.
No, OMG is a fine initialism. It's been in use since 1917. The first citation that we know of for OMG was the Lord of the British Admiralty writing a letter to Winston Churchill. You know, these are two relatively educated and influential speakers of the English language, one might presume. It's not a recent thing. It's now almost 100 years old. There is literally nothing that bothers me about literally itself. Literally, it's a fine word to use in that sense. I think people generally understand what you're saying when you use literally in a figurative fashion. If you're going to defend a word and say that it should go back to its earlier meaning, why not go all the way? Go back 500 years instead of 300 years. Go back 1,000 years. Why is it that these the people who say that you know, back when I was a kid, we learned, you know, English so much better. We observed these rules. So that rules. People who want to go back in time, they only want to go back to a certain time. Nobody ever says, well, let's bring back the 8 possible case endings of Old English. That was a lot of fun. Of course not. It's just incredibly complex to go back to that. So we want to go back to certain kind of imaginary time and place in language, but it won't happen. And the dirty secret here is that And I, it's not really a dirty secret. It's an open secret. And I love saying this to people because it, under the guise of mollifying them, I think I annoy even more people than I do naturally. It's that by the time you have noticed that there is a language use that bothers you, it is certainly too late for you to do anything about it.
Well, I think you've finally exercised the English language prude in me, and I feel I can do anything and say anything now as long as I mean it. And thank you so much. It was quite a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I can't wait to see the emails we'll get. Ammon Shaikh's new book is a history of linguistic aggravation. It's called Bad English. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, hit me, Christian Bordahl, with those emails.
Barbara Bogue, first of all, are there to be no rules? Is it to be an English language
here.
Free-for-all?
The standard bearer for
fine
English.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I happen to notice, Barbara, that you posted yesterday on Facebook about this interview you'd be doing with Ammon Shaikh and his book, Bad English.
They're still coming in.
It seems like
comments.
You have some FB buddies that are real grammar hardliners.
I know.
Some
I'm
things
not
that
proud
drive
of
them
this
crazy. Based off
they?
Of...
For instance?
Impactful, between you and I, irregardless, supposedly, for all intensive purposes.
I love that one, actually.
I could care less. I would have went, or just would have.
Look,
beginning
I
a sentence
went.
With
I
so.
I am from Pennsylvania.
Yes.
That, also, the floor needs swept. I'm surprised no one said that one.
Well, there's plenty of them, Barbara. There's no shortage, and anyone who wants to chime in with their grammar unfortunates that they don't like, send us something.
Heap it on us. I love them. And there are plenty more. That's it for us for today. Thank goodness with the English. I'll see you all tomorrow. And you can stay tuned for To the Point with Warren Olney. He's up next here on KCRW and KCRW.com.